Welcome to What is Going Om for New Thought from the Edge of Om. Each week on Om Time's flagship radio show, veteran broadcaster, author, and media consultant Sandy Sedgbeer conducts thought-provoking interviews with inspirational authors, artists, musicians, scientists, speakers, and filmmakers who are working at the point where spirituality and science meet consciousness at the very edge of Om. Here is your host, Sandy Sedgbeer.
Hello. Today's guest, Stephen G. Post, is widely known as a contributor to the study of medical humanities, positive psychology, research on altruism and love, clinical bioethics, the care of deeply forgetful people, and as the lead author of the best-selling book, When Good Things Happen to Good People, How to Live a Longer, Healthier, Happier Life by the Simple Act of Giving. But there's a spiritual side to Stephen Post's life story, which he shares in his newest book. Stephen G. Post joins me today to discuss this book, God and Love on Route 80, The Hidden Mystery of Human Connectedness, which weaves together 13 episodes of synchronicity from his life journey to demonstrate that there are no coincidences in this world, that our paths are in fact connected by a powerful force, which, if we pay close attention, can not only carry us all toward our destinies, but ultimately provides proof of humanity's fundamental oneness. Stephen Post, welcome.
Thank you, Sandy. It's a delight to be with you.
Stephen, so you were the perfect child, an A student until at the age of 18, while at St. Paul's School in New Hampshire, you had the first of a series of recurring dreams in which a blue angel spoke to you and showed you a vision. And that dream compelled you to leave behind the life your father had planned for you and embark on a cross-country journey and a shocking encounter that set the stage for a lifelong spiritual journey. So let's talk about that vision that you had, that recurring dream, that blue angel, and what happened on that shocking journey that took you west to California and resulted in a really surprising encounter.
Well, I'd be happy to talk about that, and it always amazes me that this is how my life in essence got started. I was 15. I was a perfectly ordinary kid, but spiritually inclined at a prep school in Concord, New Hampshire, St. Paul's. And for about a year, I had a recurring dream. It recurred six times. I would be just about waking up in the morning, kind of betwixt and between, and I would see a road to the west with a heavy haze. And as I walked west on the road, eventually I saw to my left the face of a young man with stringy blonde hair leaning over on the left as if about to jump into the water below. And then a blue angel appeared. Just the face of the angel, in a very feminine voice, it said, she said, I suppose I can say, if you save him, you too shall live. And then the haze lifted, everything was bright blue, and the dream was over. And I had no idea what to do about this, because I didn't know if I was feeling dyspeptic from a bad hot dog or whatever. I'd been too long in the sun. But I would meditate about this, and I talked about it with my classmates. We had a wonderful course on ancient history, sacred studies, and my teacher, who was a Yale Div School grad, Rod Wells, took me down to New Haven one day to Yale Divinity School to talk about my dream with a class of students preparing for ministry, and they were studying adolescent spirituality. So I spoke about this, and they ultimately said, so what does this mean to you? And I told them, well, you know, we all read Emerson's Oversoul, and we read Hindu classics, And it's all really interesting from a literary point of view, but I actually wonder now if it's really not true, this deep connection and the mystery of our oneness. So fast forward a couple of years later, I'm in New York, and I've got a job that Rod Wells had gotten for me, my teacher, tutoring. I love tutoring, and I was going to work in the Bronx. My parents thought that was too dangerous, so we had an argument for 2 or 3 days, a pretty significant falling out, and ultimately I said, Dad, if I can't do this, what am I going to do? And he said, well, you can work in Bill DeBono's lampshade factory, because my dad was in the lampshade industry and the furniture industry in New York. So for 2 weeks, I cut cardboard. And then one Friday night, I decided that was enough. So I took Dad's old secondhand gray Mercedes 190, and I just drove west. I drove west over the George Washington Bridge, and there was a sign. I'd never been west on over the bridge before, and it said Route 80 West. And I just followed it. And I got all the way to the middle of Pennsylvania, and it was probably 5 in the morning, and I was thinking, you know, maybe I should turn around and make sure I have a reputation that's untarnished with my family. But just as I was thinking that, just that moment, the generator on the car broke, and all the electricity was gone, the engine was gone. All I could do was get over on the right side. I looked around. It was cornfields for miles. This is near Lewisburg, Pennsylvania. So I did the only thing that a 17-year-old kid could do. I reached in the glove compartment and I wrote a note that said, it's in the book, to the Pennsylvania State Police, please return this car to Henry A. V. Post, 44 Davison Lane East, West Islip, New York, 516-669-5655, from his son, Stephen, who no longer works in the lampshade factory. It's a historic letter, and I put my thumb out, and a big truck came along. Just to make a long story short, I got out to San Francisco because, again, I'm going west, and I had a cousin, George Lamont, who lived in the Mission District on Chenery Street, and I made my way to his house, and he let me sleep on the floor. It was actually an apartment. He was a superintendent. And I spent the summer doing Nichiren Shosho Buddhist chanting, playing classical guitar in Hispanic restaurants. And I drew a very bad draft number. So I called the people at Reed College in Portland, Oregon. I turned them down. I was supposed to head to Swarthmore. But I said, look, I really need to have a spot in the entering class or I'm going to be over in Vietnam. And they were accommodating. So this is really a powerful story now, because early one morning in early September, I'm in front of the Nichiren Shoshu Chapel temple with George and Gus and friends, and they gave me a going away present because I had to now head north, hitchhike north to Oregon, and it was a Gahon Zone. Gahon Zone is a sacred Buddhist scroll, and it's got wonderful symbols on it about the oneness of consciousness and interdependence and universal kindness. So it's very powerful. I put that in my backpack and I took the Market Street bus and I got to the Golden Gate Park and I walked across the park and I walked up across, now it's about 8 in the morning, I walked up across the Golden Gate Bridge on the left, and it was completely hazed over, so I couldn't see more than about 3 feet in front of me. I got all the way to the middle of the bridge and then I heard a rustling to my left. And I was surprised by it. So I squinted and I looked and I saw the outline of a young man whose face looked something like, anyway, I thought, the face in my dream. And the blonde hair was kind of stringy and strangly. And he was leaning out as if to jump. So I said to him very quietly, like the angel, empathically, I said, I truly hope you're not planning to jump. And then he reacted because I had invaded his moment, his space. And he just screamed out at me, actually screamed some Shakespeare, life is empty nothingness. And I told him that sounds really powerful, especially when you're about to jump off a bridge. But can we talk about it? And I told him I thought I was here for a reason, that I'd had a dream 2 years prior and 3,000 miles away. And it was if time and place meant nothing. And here I was, and I told him about the dream at St. Paul's. I told him about talking about it at Yale University. I told him about the argument I had with my parents and about the car that broke down just when I was thinking about doing a U-turn and coming back to New York, out in the middle of Pennsylvania, and the note to the Pennsylvania, and so forth. I told him all the details, and he was completely astonished. So he thought I was a little bit crazy, and I said, well, I'm not the one out there about to jump. And eventually, you know, I was able to talk him in. I said, look, I've got something for you that I think can turn your whole life around. I have something called the Cajon Zone. And I'm told, anyway, that if you have this Cajon Zone, it will bring luck. And so he asked me to explain that, and I took it out of my backpack. I explained a little bit of it from the other side of the railing. He was on one side of the railing. I was on the pedestrian side. And I said, look, his name was Harry. If you come over here, I'm going to explain this to you very deeply, and I'm going to give it to you, but there's a condition. So he came over. I talked with him. We got along nicely for about 20 minutes or half an hour. And I said, now you need to take this Cajon Zone, walk down the bridge heading south toward the park, get the Market Street bus, and go to 4 Chenery Street, and bring this note, which I wrote for him right then, another note to my cousin George. This is Harry. Please get him a shower. Let him sleep on the same place on your living room floor where I slept. Let him meet Gus down at the temple and take care of him. And so I waved goodbye to Harry, and I went north on the bridge because I'm going to Oregon. But as I went north, suddenly all the fog and the haze just completely lifted. And everything was bright blue. And all I could think at the time, because I was 17 and I wasn't sophisticated, I know I wasn't reading Carl Jung too much or anything like that, I just felt that somehow I'd had an experience that brought me together in some kind of planned way, that there was this cherishing love energy in the universe that somehow set this up perfectly. And so that I would meet Harry there. And I went up to Reed College, and, you know, things happened at Reed, too, that were very interesting. But that's the essence of the first episode. And ever since then, I've been a believer in this idea of non-local mind, you know, the idea that our minds are more than just tissue and cells, but really that there's a great mystery to the mind that connects all of us and possibly all of reality.
And you could almost say that the universal mind has gone out of its way to reiterate that to you over and over again. I mean, that story has crept up, and you know, you've told it to many people on your journey. You mm-hmm. told it to Joseph Campbell, who you happened to meet at college, and he said to you that it, you know, this wasn't about luck, this was synchronicity. And then you also had other Blue Angel experiences as well. It's, you know, it's as if it was repeated again and again for you, mm-hmm. just to keep you on track.
Yeah, it's really true. I mean, you know, I dropped out of the University of Pennsylvania, where I was studying immunology, and I, as a doctoral student, and I went to the University of Chicago Divinity School, because it was really a great place to do world spirituality. So I was sitting in the Swift Kick coffee shop with Joseph Campbell, who was visiting that quarter, and also Mircea Eliade, who wrote all the great books about shamanism. And I told them both the story, and Joseph Campbell said, synchronicity, not luck. And then Eliade, who was kind of like an ET type figure, really old, hunched over, hard to understand, lots of tufts of hair coming out of his ears. He said, is it all synchronicity? You know. But yeah, all my life I've had hard times like anyone else, but I've always had confidence that we can follow a destiny, that we all have a destiny. And if we make room for it and don't just fill up our lives with our own little goals, it can bring beautiful things. And then Chagall comes in later on, too.
Yes, and you must tell us that story as well. I don't know if we've got time quickly for you to tell us before the break. If you can condense it down to about 2 minutes.
I can. Yeah. So eventually, you know, I wind up teaching at Fordham University in philosophy in New York, and I'm living in Tarrytown. I got my wife Mitsuko and my little 2-year-old daughter Emma, and I have an office mate named Gabe Gomez, who's a historian of world spiritualities. And he asked me how I got into this field. And I said, well, I had a dream when I was 15, and I explained it to him. And he said, you've got to leave this office right now. You've got to walk around the reservoir and go into Pocono Hills and go to the Union Church and look at the Chagall window, the big, beautiful blue Chagall window at the back of the church, which I did. It was about a 15-minute walk. And there it was, you know, Chagall's just incredible blue window and all the figures of angels and symbols from different world religions. And I came to start studying Chagall pretty heavily and even did a course on Chagall. But it turned out that when he was 17, he was living in a little Russian city. His dad had a factory, believe it or not, where they pickled herring. Lo and behold, he doesn't want to work in the factory. And so he runs away. He runs away to St. Petersburg, and he's sleeping in the alley. He has no money. He's sleeping on a mattress, and he sees the whole alleyway filled with blue light, and he sees the wings of a blue angel, and he feels very peaceful. And then the angel ascends, leaving blue behind. And he went out that next day, and he did his first painting called The Apparition, which is a painting of an angel with a blue background. And the rest of his life, when he died outside of Paris, he was doing a painting of a blue angel. And he said blue was the color of love, and he was completely mystical. And even Picasso said, look, you know, Chagall is so great, no one can understand him, but he must have angels dancing around his head.
That's an incredible story. You're listening to What Is Going On. I'm Sandy Sedgbeer, and I'm speaking with Stephen G. Post, founder and president of the Institute for Research on Unlimited Love and director of the Center for Medical Humanities, Compassionate Care and Bioethics at Stony Brook University in New York. And we're talking about his latest book, God and Love on Route 80, The Hidden Mystery of Human Connectedness. We'll be back with more from Stephen Post after this break.
The future of internet radio is here. Own Times Radio. I Own FM.
Ascending Hearts is no ordinary dating site, but a spiritual dating site with a purpose, to link you with your soulmate. We engineer the serendipity so you can trust that you will attune with someone that has the same matching vibration as you. Ascending Hearts, the conscious dating site for the spiritually aware. Try Ascending Hearts for free, ascendinghearts.com.
More than 24 million Americans have an autoimmune disorder, and that number continues to grow. I'm Sharon Saylor, and I'm one of those 24 million. To put that number in perspective, cancer affects about 9 million and heart disease up to 22 million. That's why I've brought together top experts and those thriving regardless of their diagnosis to bring you the latest, most up-to-date information. Join me, Sharon Saylor, Friday night, 7 p.m. Eastern, for the Autoimmune Hour on Life Interrupted Radio to find out how to live your life uninterrupted.
Hello, I'm Sandy Sedgbeer, host of On Time's flagship radio show, What Is Going On. As a long-time editor, book judge, spiritual magazine publisher and radio host, I've read thousands of books and interviewed hundreds of authors and teachers, so I know what's worth reading and what isn't. Now, with the spiritual book market growing increasingly crowded, more and more people are seeking my help in finding the authentic voices, the empowering tools and the genuine skip the BS guidance that will make the most difference to their spiritual development. So I decided to make it easier by bringing my knowledge, experience and considerable network of contacts together in the No BS Spiritual Book Club. There are no ads, no joining fees, no obligations and no BS. Just an ever-growing library compiled by recognisable and respected names of the 10 best books that helped them the most on their journeys, plus free book excerpts, audios, and live video interviews where you can quiz them about their spiritual journeys and their 10 best list choices. Your time and money are valuable, your spiritual journey even more so. If you're looking for genuine guidance from people who have walked this path before you, check out sedgbeer.com. Click on the No BS Spiritual Book Club tab and join the club. That's sedgbeer.com, S-E-D-G-B-E-E-R.com. I'll see you there.
A social distancing tip.
Putting distance between yourself and others is critical to slowing the spread of coronavirus. So here are ways to stay in contact without the physical contact part. Call, send a text, set up a video conference, post on social media, dedicate a song on the radio. If you have symptoms of fever, dry cough, and shortness of breath, call your health care provider before going to their office. For more info, visit coronavirus.gov.
Let's all do our part, because we're all hashtag alone together. Brought to you by the Ad Council.
Welcome back. Stephen Post, I want to talk a little bit more about some of the synchronicities that have shaped your thinking and your life, because there have been many, and it seems to me that your entire path, it's almost as if you had some sheepdog coming along and nudging you here and leading you over there along the way. So tell us about a couple of the really standout synchronicities that have made a huge difference to your life.
Well, there are quite a few. I mean, if I go back in time, you know, Reed College, I'm almost 18 years old. It's late January. It doesn't snow up in Oregon, but it rains, and it was kind of icy, and I was loving school up there. Steve Jobs was a student there, and there were courses like Alchemy 101. It was really amazing. So one Friday night, I'm sitting in the coffee shop about 9 o'clock, and a guy comes bounding in through the door with this wild hair, and his eyes were bright and lit up, and he said, "I'm Andy, who wants to go for a ride on my brand new Harley Davidson Shovelhead, the fastest motorcycle in the world?" And I, like a complete fool, I said, "I'll go." I wanted to show off a little bit, so I went out and I got on this bike, and it was slushy and a little bit icy. And this guy took off. He hit 150 miles an hour within a couple of minutes. He went down the Pacific Coast Highway. I was screaming. I really thought I was dead. I was in tears. I was asking him to stop and let me off, and he was just laughing into the night. And then finally he did a U-turn, and he drove me back to the Reed College campus exactly to the point where he picked me up. And I stumbled off that motorcycle. I thought I had a near-death experience. It was that intense. And I walked across the bridge to Ackerman Dormitory, where I was living. It's just as I crossed the threshold, there's a comm room. Now, I never answered the telephone. Just wasn't my thing. It was a payphone on the wall. But as it rang, I felt pushed. I mean, it was as though there was really a spiritual energy. Well, I turned around. It wasn't visible to my eye, but I just felt pushed to go over to the phone and pick it up. So I picked it up and I said, "Hello." Now, note, it's 11 o'clock at night now in California. So in New York, right, it's like 2 in the morning. I said, "Hello." And it was my mother. And she said, "Oh, thank God you're alive." And she said, "I had this terrible premonition that you had died. And I woke up, I was sweating, I told your dad, Henry, and we're here, and we just want to know that you're okay." And I said, "Mommy, that's amazing intuition, because I thought I was dead too." And I explained to her the story of the motorcycle. And at that time, my mom and I kind of found our common connection, because we realized that there was something about mind and love and these fields of connectivity that we don't understand, but they're real. And she, again, 3,000 miles away in her sleep, knew that I was really severely imperiled. And so, in fact, she was an abstract expressionist painter, and she even did a beautiful painting called The Blue Angel Dream, because I eventually explained this to her that night on the phone. So that's another one. And there are many, many of them that I could talk about. But with regard to Chagall, so fast forward, like, you know, I've been 20 years teaching at Case Medical School and medical compassion and humanism and communication and all sort of inspired by the angel, if you save him, you too shall live. And so I got a call from people in Pocantico Hills, which is the Rockefeller enclave, and they asked me if I would come and give a talk about Chagall's Blue Angel, because I'd actually written a few things here and there. And I said, sure. So I went there and I gave a talk, and I drove home that night. It was in November of 2015. I drove home over the Throgs Neck Bridge, got out to Stony Brook where we lived, and I got into the house. It's very late. It's about 2 in the morning. And I have an email from Duray Ahmad, who's like the most famous Muslim feminist mystic in Pakistan. She lives in Lahore. And she's on the board of my Institute for Research on Unlimited Love, so named by Sir John Templeton, by the way, who is a great mentor and friend. And she said, the website's been taken down, destroyed. And there it was. It was Team DZ ISIS and this black flag. And so I asked my board members what we should do. And they said, well, let's make a positive out of a negative. Let's have a big international essay contest and ask young people from all over the world to write reflective, you know, existential reflective essays about how they successfully pushed back against peer pressure to hate other people just because they didn't share their beliefs. And so we did this. It went out all over the globe. And lo and behold, at that time I was working with the UN Population Panel on Spirituality and Sustainable Development, and they kind of got wind of this ISIS hack. So they asked me if I would wish to bring all these young people. There were several thousand, actually, who had responded, and there were about 10 winners who all got good cash prizes, by the way. If we'd want to do the program for World Youth Day at the UN in August of 2016. And I said, yeah. And so we filled the entire United Nations headquarters with young people doing these beautiful essays and songs and rap-type things on unlimited love. And in the book, you know, the agenda for that evening is, or that afternoon is there in one of the later chapters. But that wasn't something I planned. It was just total synchronicity. And it just happened that somehow I had been called back to the Union Church to do that talk, and it, you know, it was way beyond anything I could possibly have dreamed up. But it was beautiful, and I consider that synchronicity, when things just seem too perfect to be true, when somehow everything falls into place and you do something that's profoundly meaningful, but it's completely beyond your own vision, you know. So that's
absolutely
part of it.
So you talk about the universal mind. What is that to you? Is it God? I mean, how do you explain it?
Well, I think of, you know, universal mind is fine. I sometimes think of infinite mind. I sometimes use the word original mind. But it's original mind and or of pure unlimited love. And this is the creative, loving consciousness that is eternal, that existed before the Big Bang and the creation of the universe, and that in fact underlies all of reality, that is ultimate reality, not just in terms of thermodynamic constants, the mind of God type thinking of Paul Davies and John Barrow and the mathematicians, but also that just underlies reality at the level of fine energy. And so I'm committed to that view, but also in a special way, this mind of love resides within us, because we are given a small portion of that mind as our own. And that's what explains our incredible creative moments, when Ramanujan, the great young adolescent Hindu who really knew no math, when he was having these visions as he prayed at the foot of his goddess in southern India, and he would write these formulas down in the dirt and later come by and put them in his notebook. That's the basis of a lot of quantum physics, and those two notebooks are the middle of Trinity College, Cambridge University. So when people talk about premonitions, when they talk about extraordinary creativity, when they talk about deeply meaningful dreams that somehow come into reality, when they talk about synchronicities that blow their socks off, that's because we are participants. There's really only one mind. And here I agree with Larry Dossey and Deepak Chopra. Mm-hmm. There's one mind, and we are given some small portion of it. So we're all much more connected than we know. So, yeah, that is God. God is an infinite mind of pure, unlimited love. And it's absolutely my view and the view of many other people.
And, of course, synchronicity played a wonderful role in bringing you together with Sir John Templeton, who invited you, to found the Institute for Research on Unlimited Love. I mean, it's all kind of come together, hasn't it? All around this subject of unlimited love.
Yeah, it's funny, because I've been in medical schools for like 30 years, and I've loved my work here with the medical students. But about 1990, I was at a meeting on spirituality and health in Virginia, and Sir John Templeton happened to be in the lobby because he was funding this. And I went over and I sat next to him, and we talked for about 2 hours just about love, about unlimited love, about not human love. Because human love to him wasn't that interesting, just human emotionality. But he thought there was a true spiritual dynamic underlying the universe. He was a real metaphysician. And we just saw so much in common between us that I would eventually be working with him. In fact, when he died in 2008. He was in Lyford Key in Nassau. And his son, Jack Templeton, who was a trauma surgeon, called me on my flip phone at the time and said, "Dad is dying, and he wants to write one book that he can't write. He doesn't have time to do it, and he wants you to do it." And I said, "Oh my gosh, Jack, I don't know if I could do that. What's the title?" And he said, "Well, he wants it to be called Ultimate Realities, Unlimited Love." And then I thought, "Oh my goodness. Well, could you get back to your father?" To Dad, who's on his deathbed, and ask him if he could change it a little bit and make a question mark. So Jack came back about 3 or 4 minutes later, and he said, "Yeah, he says it's okay. Is ultimate reality unlimited love? Question mark." So I did that book for the Templeton Press, and it was really a statement about how Sir John viewed all of reality. And this is still very much alive in my life. I mean, it just goes on. Like 4 or 5 years ago, I'm sitting here right where I am now in my office at the medical school. This Korean American medical student who's really struggling with med school, but she's brilliant. She happens to be very spiritual and very theological, and she doesn't feel that she's connecting with people. She's thinking about leaving school, so somehow she finds my door and she says, "Could I have a moment with you?" And I just talk with her a minute, and I said, "Yeah, why don't you email me, and maybe tomorrow we can get together, because I've got a really busy afternoon." And then I'm right here at this desk, where you can't see that, but I'm right here, and over my left shoulder, I just felt this incredible energy, and it was shocking. I just didn't know what to say about it. Again, I couldn't see anything. It was like what I experienced years and years earlier at Reed College by the telephone, and I just knew intuitively that I should drop everything and just spend my time with this young gal, which I did. I canceled all my appointments, and I spent the next 3 hours with her, and it was a very deep emotional engagement where she was processing a lot of things. And she did take a year off. I became her mentor, and she's now practicing preventive medicine, and she's doing beautiful work. I'm even officiating her wedding. I would be doing it in about a month, except that it was called off because of the COVID epidemic, and so it's going to be delayed for a year. But if it wasn't for that energy, that synchronizing energy that brings us together in ways that are so totally uncanny, And she and I, we still talk about this event, and she remembers exactly what happened, and it was just stunning to her, and it was stunning to me, and she's pretty spiritual, and she kind of had a similar sort of feel. So I believe that there is this creative love in the universe that is greater than anything we can imagine, and there's going to come a time when we are all perfectly aware of it, and that will be what I like to call an age of pure unlimited love.
Mm. You also had another encounter with a boy on a ledge, didn't you?
Well, when I was at Case Western Reserve University, I spent 20 years there teaching. And I'm not a physician. Let me get clear. I'm not an MD. I'm a PhD from the University of Chicago Divinity School in world religions and ethics and sort of medicine and religion. So I was at Case Western. I was in my office, and I got a phone call from the adolescent psychiatry department in Hanna Pavilion, and they said, we have a 19-year-old boy here who has tried to kill himself. He actually swallowed some terrible kind of cleanser, which was really devastating, and he was under 24/7 observation. And they said, look, we can't make any progress with him because, you know, he actually makes some sense. So they said, could you come over here? So I went over there, and I spent about 2 or 3 hours with this kid. And it turns out they let him have some books in his room. He had a hospital room there, and it was all these books like The Selfish Gene, Lord of the Flies. He had Being in Nothingness, Sartre, where anyone who looks at you with kindness is just trying to get to your pocketbook. You know. I mean, it was incredible, and he said, "There's no meaning in life. I don't see why I should study. Why should I go on and just, you know, what's the point of it all?" And so I'm trying to kill myself. And I said, you know, you're reading these books very, very accurately, because that's basically what they leave with you with. If you even think that there's human kindness and meaning in life, believe me, it's just your selfish replicating DNA coil trying to foist itself into the future through you, thinking when you're kind, when you're not, and so forth. And so, you know, we talked, and he eventually, he stabilized a bit. He was medicated. He went back down to Cincinnati, where he was from, and I invited him. I said, look, if you come back here, you can work for my institute. I'll give you a research position, and he did come back, and I actually took him down. There's on Lee Road in Cleveland. There, believe it or not, there's a Nichiren Shoho Buddhist temple there, and I took him down and I got him a Gohonzon zone, and he's had a fine life. So that was one of those other unbelievably uncanny kinds of things, and I explained to him my Blue Angel dream and all kinds of things. And so you just have to be totally open to surprises, and things will come into your path.
Yeah, be willing to pay attention. You're listening to What Is Going On. I'm Sandy Sedgbeer, and with me today is founder and president of the Institute for Research on Unlimited Love, Stephen G. Post. We're talking about his latest book, God and Love on Route 80, The Hidden Mystery of Human Connectedness. We'll be back with more from Stephen Post after the break.
The cutting edge of conscious radio, OM Times Radio, IOM FM. Being a radio host on IOM FM allows you to build your show on a rich platform with the power of the internet to fulfill your outreach goals and connect with a very specialized and global online audience, unlimited by time and distance. OM Times Radio will provide you with web relevance, a recognizable conscious brand, and with the standard of excellence that has accompanied every single OM Times endeavor. Host your show with OM Times Radio Network.
Hello, I'm Lisa Barry. Join me every Monday at 1 p.m. Eastern Time for Light on Living, a chance to see new, hear different, and feel more as I shine the spotlight on all the ways to lighten the load of life's challenges. Light on Living is your link to that new way you're looking for, that new understanding that will enhance your life, and that positive connection that will support your growth. So join me, and you'll gain insight and start to see things in a new way that motivates you.
I'm Fidel Nshombo. I was born in a city called the Bukavu in the Congo.
We were a loving family, and then, boom, everything that I had disappeared in a single day.
People think that when you are a refugee and they resettle to America, you know, your problems are done. They don't understand that that's the beginning of everything.
I was not born a refugee. I was made one.
It's time we welcome refugee families with open arms. Learn more at EmbraceRefugees.org, brought to you by the Ad Council.
Welcome back. Stephen Post, so here we are, joining the dots of your life. You know, this blue angel trailing through your life and all these little dots that are joining up. And you get to meet Sir John Templeton, and you found the Unlimited Love Institute, which enables you to fund studies at nation's top universities to prove all the life-enhancing benefits of caring, kindness, compassion, love, which leads you to write or co-write the best-selling book, Why Good Things Happen to Good People, How to Live a Longer, Happier, Healthier Life by the Simple Act of Giving. And all of this seems to be orchestrated to get you to a place where you can share, prove, demonstrate, express all the things that we need to hear, that giving, that love, caring, kindness and compassion are actually the best things we can do to extend our own life, to fulfill, make our life fulfilling, to, you know, give us the satisfaction in life, to help others. And it's just like this incredible pie that somebody's baked, and you've been putting all the ingredients together through all these synchronicities in your life.
Well, I've been fortunate. You know, I don't think we make our lives. I think that's a really arrogant attitude. I think we are on a journey, and we encounter all kinds of people and circumstances. And it's up to us to respond creatively. But we always have to remember that even the difficult moments, and there are difficult moments, they're like a Jackson Pollock painting. They're opportunities to turn a negative into a positive. When he threw that junky bit of paint down on the floor in that barn out in East Hampton, it just looked like hell at first. But by the time he's done covering it with beautiful, energetic lines of color, at the end of the day, it's a thing of beauty. So we always have to be open to the ways in which hardship is an opportunity. I truly believe that. The obstacles that we face are opportunities. You know, I came here from Cleveland, and it was very tough. It was 2008, and I didn't particularly want to leave, but the president of this university, Stony Brook, Shirley Chisholm, Shirley Kenny had called me, and she said, "We want someone to affect the culture of healthcare across New York State. We want you to teach compassionate interactions in very practical, granular ways that can be demonstrated." So I said, "Okay," and she said, "Governor Spitzer is going to be very helpful to you." She was the governor of New York at the time. So we sold our house. I took Route 80 east, got out to Stony Brook on the North Shore of Long Island, and that night, the front page of the New York Post was a picture of Governor Eliot Spitzer in his socks and T-shirt and underwear because he had been busy with, illicit relationships on the taxpayer dollar, no less. And it said, "Governor no more." And it was the worst night of my life. And my wife and my son were mad at me because they suddenly realized we'd left home where we'd known people for 20 years. And I was practically in tears. But then I also realized that this was an opportunity. And so, you know, I just worked really hard to build a program. I made a special effort to focus on the lives of faculty and students. And over time, it worked out very, very beautifully. And And that's the thing, that's the real secret to the journey of life. And Joseph Campbell would say this too. You know, there's no ultimate negative. It may look like a negative, and it's very seriously negative, and I'm not trying to be Pollyannish, but you just have to recognize that this infinite mind wants us to grow, and hardships are there. You know, I just spent the last 4 months doing a lot of counseling for COVID families because this place is a big center for treatment, and you know they're having terrible hardships. Their loved ones are dying in the intensive care unit, unable to communicate because they have these ventilator masks on and so forth. It's very, very harsh. But I just think that even the most difficult situations can yield a profound growth and ultimately move us forward. I think this whole thing spiritually is kind of a way of moving us to the next level. I won't say it's indemnity, but it's just a way of making us focus on the spiritual and on what's really important and on one another. And I think in the end, we're going to be a better world for it.
Well, I agree with you, and I disagree a little bit when you say we don't make our lives. I think that we co-create our lives, mm-hmm. and by being open to the synchronicities and the signs and choosing to turn what could be a negative situation into a positive, we are co-creating.
I agree. Yeah, I would agree entirely.
Yeah.
It's how we respond. It's so important.
Yes, exactly. One of the things that really interests me is that, you know, there are two things that I think that among many that are happening in our society that we need to address is that that are much neglected are the young and the elderly. And you say, you know, that we need to be focusing more on raising kind children, emotionally intelligent children, and helping them to develop spiritually. And I know from your book that you've also spent a lot of time working, supporting, assisting, researching with the elderly too, the loved ones, the ones that you talk about, the deeply forgetful, which I think is a beautiful phrase. And I think that, you know, the what you've demonstrated through your other book, you know, the Why Good Things Happen, and in this book as well, is that helping one another is one of the best ways in the world of helping ourselves. And, you know, isn't it a beautiful thing that we're not just helping ourselves, that we can give to others, support those that need it, the young, the elderly, whoever it is. And in the process, we are enriching our own lives and certainly extending our own lives.
Yeah, absolutely. I call it compassionate flourishing. Every once in a while, you know, Sandy, someone is hoodwinked by this idea that somehow if you can't get a reciprocal gain, if you can't calculate a payback, you're a sucker. We actually did an article in a psychology journal about widows and widowers who had been happily married for many years and were going through a long period of bereavement and grieving when they lost their loved one. So I got a call from the New York Society of Widows and Widowers. There is such a thing. And they're having their annual conference in New York. So I went into the city and I gave this talk. And you know, I said, look, the best thing you can do to cope with your hardship is to volunteer. What the study showed was that people who were helping others in their neighborhoods, formally or informally volunteering, that they actually were getting through this process of grief and bereavement more quickly and also more enduringly. So I gave a pretty careful talk, and then it was Q&A. So there was. I said, does anybody have any questions? There was this guy in the back of this hall. There was like 600 or 700 people there. And he's waving his hand frantically. And I said, yes, sir. And he just shouted out. He said, I don't care what you say, buddy. I don't do nothing for nothing. And people don't realize that you know, I mean, it's nice for folks you're working with to have an attitude of gratitude and maybe to express a little appreciation. I think that can be very helpful. It's just simple etiquette. But you don't want to expect anything back from them. So it's the internal benefits. And that's what my work has been about so much, just the ways in which the whole neurological circuitry of care and connection gets active and how people feel liberated, a kind of helper's high, and what's involved in that. And we just actually published a paper in the American Journal of Preventive Medicine with Matt Lee and others from Harvard, just showing definitively that the evidence that it's good to be good, you know, from your own internal perspective and dealing with struggles and getting away from the problems of the self and so forth, in flourishing and finding happiness, that's so powerful now that it can be prescribed. It can actually be recommended in a doctor's office. And people in California now, in San Francisco, are doing that, and they're doing it in the adolescent clinics in a lot of places. They're actually connecting kids. Maybe they're opioid addicted or whatever, and they've been so disconnected. They've been running on empty. They haven't been feeling community. They've been struggling. They have affluenza, as they say. You know, when you connect these young people with opportunities to help others, it's very therapeutic.
Absolutely. I want to talk briefly, we don't have much time left, about the current situation that's happening. You wrote in God and Love on Route 80 about how anger is sometimes necessary and positive. We're experiencing an outpouring of anger across society right now. There's a lot of polarization taking place, and I imagine both sides feel that their anger is justified. Where is that line between positive, necessary anger and the unnecessary, destructive rage that's being expressed? I mean, how do we move beyond anger to find forgiveness, love, acceptance, and reconciliation?
Well, the violence is unacceptable. People can have righteous indignation, which is not just catering to your anger and going down that negative vortex into a red rage that is ultimately terribly destructive for you and terribly destructive for the people around you. But a kind of righteous indignation about things is perfectly fine, and I'm all for peaceful demonstrations when there's these horrendous episodes police abuse and so forth. But we ultimately have to get beyond this horrible polarization, and we have to realize that we have a shared humanity. And it's not just, you know, that we are biologically connected, that somebody in one part of the world can have a COVID infection and then by airplane it floats around and gets all over. You know, there is that sort of sense of biological interdependence that Martin Luther King wrote about very eloquently, but there's also this interdependence within the one mind, within the infinite mind, and we have to cultivate our spirituality. I think a lot of people I know have been cultivating, they've been meditating, they've been praying. I'm up every morning, 5 o'clock, even 4 o'clock, and I'm just meditating and doing loving meditations for people in New York and Cleveland and all over the U.S. and all over the world, and just trying to contribute to a consciousness of oneness. Because in the final analysis, we cannot make progress if we don't realize that the path to oneness is by working with everybody creatively in this kind of unity of consciousness, and mm-hmm. and not trying to create oneness by elimination. You know, that's when you get into genocide. Everybody has to be somehow like me, and if they're not like me, then they can be put on the shelf, and I don't care about them. I can inflict wanton harm. No, I mean, you know, all the great unifiers, Gandhi, Lincoln, Wilberforce, all the great unifiers have struggled because they're a threat to people who just love one small fragment of humanity. And a lot of these great unifiers have been assassinated. Martin Luther King is a case in point. Rabin would be a point. But to me, you know, we just have to have the spiritual depth and leadership to recognize that our only hope is to come together. And I think we'll realize that. I think somehow after the worst moments of the last month are a little bit more in the mirror, and there are real reforms in criminal justice and in police techniques and so forth, I think we're going to realize the only way to go is to go together.
Mm. Yeah, that's a really good note on which to end this conversation. The only way to survive and the only way to go is always together.
Yes.
Stephen Post, thank you for joining us today. And thank you for writing this book.
Well, thank you, Sandy, for having me. It's a delight, and you're a lot of fun to speak with.
Thank you. For more information about Stephen Post's work and books, visit stephengpost.com, S-T-E-P-H-E-N, gpost.com, and unlimitedloveinstitute.org. I'm Sandy Sedgbeer. You can learn more about me and the No BS Spiritual Book Club at my website, sedgbeer.com. And in the meantime, I'll be back with you again with another edition of What is Going On at the same time next week. Till then, it's goodbye from me.